So, Alan Dre, welcome you to the podium. This is your first meeting, I think?
This is my first meeting.
Very good. Welcome to the ASA meetings. Biological control of weeds, close to my heart. Reconstituting God's plan. Al?
We hope.
Yes. You bet.
So we're going to diverge a little bit from most of what happens here at ASA because there's going to be very little theological input to this talk, for which, if that's what you were hoping to hear, I will apologize up front. But I'm a field ecologist, and so that's more where I speak from. I thank you for coming, and especially knowing that we're all prepping for Francis Collins later. I will try to promise that I can get you out of here on time so that we can get ready to eat and then wait for Francis and what he has to say. So biological control of weeds is necessary because humans move. We've been moving for a very long time. The Bible gives us examples of humans moving and migrating for a variety of reasons. We know genetically that we've been moving for millennia, and we're moving right up to the present day. Political circumstances around the world are causing people to move over and over again from place to place, either pastorally, sort of casually, or in panic, but in all cases we have to move. And as people are moving, we bring along organisms with us. Well, our previous speaker, Dr. Gonzalez, who apparently has left, was talking about parasites. We bring parasites and diseases with us, but we also bring other organisms with us as well. So as an example here, I highlighted the Polynesians, mostly because they brought a plant that I'm working on as a weed in Florida, the air potato, to Hawaii from Samoa as a medicinal plant. They also brought one of its congeners, Dioscorea alata, along as a food plant, and their favorite food plant, taro, they brought as well. And then just because they didn't want to eat plants all the time, they brought jungle fowl, which is a precursor for modern chickens. Oh, did I do the wrong one? something happened, excuse me. Okay. So not only did they bring things from where they had come, but because these were explorers, they would go to other places and then come back to their newly settled places. So these Polynesians left Hawaii, made it to the west coasts of Central and South America, where they encountered indigenous persons who had this wonderful new food that they liked, a root crop. And since they were familiar with taro and Dioscorea alata and Dioscorea bulbifera, they already were familiar with root crops and said, hey, this is pretty cool, and it's a different color than ours, and it tastes really good. And thus, sweet potato got carried back into Hawaii first and then back into Polynesia from the Americas. So we not only bring things with us that we're already familiar with, but we find things that we weren't familiar with and we move them around as well. This whole activity of humans moving crops and other organisms back and forth around the globe has led to a homogenization of biota, so much so that Beiser and his colleagues in 2012 had published a paper where they describe the fact that whether you look at a continental scale, a regional scale, a more local scale, whether you look at plants or you look at animals, in all cases, the floras and faunas around the globe have become more similar to each other now than they were in the previous 150 to 200 years. Some ecologists, as a result of that kind of homogenization, have taken to calling the post-Columbian portion of the Holocene the homogenocene. And in fact, geologists, I don't know if we have any in the room at the moment, but geologists have a formal movement going on right now, a process in which they're planning on renaming either part or all of the Holocene the Anthropocene, because they want to acknowledge the impact that humans have had on the world in general, as well as in this particular homogenization of the globe, not only biologically, but in other ways as well. So these things that have been moving around, if you're coming from one place to another and you didn't occur there originally, we call them exotic species, and they can become really problematic in many places, but not necessarily always. Exotic species can be benign. Most of us have, and in the landscape outside of where we are right now, there are plenty of species that did not occur here prior to Europeans arriving. And they exist, and we have to maintain them, feed them, water them, trim them. but they don't do anything else. They just sit and exist, and they're totally benign in the systems. Some exotic species can be beneficial, although they can simultaneously be harmful. So the European honeybee is responsible in part for the decline of native bees, pollinating bees, in many respects, in many parts of the United States. But they have also taken over the function of pollinating native species whose pollinators were lost for other reasons. And so without, in this particular example I've got here, without the European honeybee, the native cacti of California, who had lost their pollinating flies through disease, would be struggling tremendously in terms of their population dynamics, because they wouldn't be able to be getting pollinated. So these exotic species can be beneficial or benign, but they can also be harmful. They can be harmful because we want them to be harmful. We planned on them being harmful. We set them up to be harmful. The prime example that I use here is the tallgrass prairies of the middle part of the United States, where we replaced this multifaceted, very diverse plant community that was part of the tallgrass prairie with these monocultures of corn and wheat, so that we could feed ourselves. And that has been going on as long as people have been migrating as well. In fact, one of the reasons we move plants around with us is so we can feed ourselves, and we displace native species in order to have space to grow our favorite crops that are here instead. I'm not talking about any of those kinds of exotic species in the rest of my talk today. What I'm talking about are those exotic organisms that alter ecosystems, but it's not something we had planned, not something we wanted to have happen in the first place. An example from my own research is the Australian tree Melaleuca quinquennervia. It's called Kajaput or Melaleuca. And in the Everglades of Florida, the native species there, the native tree species, is cypress. And these cypress form these domes that you can see on your left. You can notice that the cypress dome is open canopy. There's lots of space between the trees. If you were to get up in close there, you would see that there is quite diverse plant community in the understory and in the midstory around and as part of these domes. But when Melaleuca comes in and gets a foothold in them, Melaleuca starts growing, and it can grow faster and taller. Everglades sawgrass prairies are actually a fire-maintained ecosystem, and Melaleuca, unfortunately, comes from a fire ecosystem in Australia. And they're better at fire than our native species are. So they reproduce rapidly. Their seeds are held on the trees. They explode when a fire comes along, and the seeds fall down, and the ash that's left behind is a perfect environment for them to grow in. They grow faster than the native species, and so they shadow out and push out the native species until eventually that dome on the right was once a cypress dome. And instead it's filled with Melaleucas that are so thick that we could not walk between them if we wanted to. So that kind of unintentional effect on ecosystems is common in a variety of cases. Now, how extensive is this problem? Exotic species comprise, in the state of Florida, where I'm from, roughly 1,200 of the 4,300 or 4,400 species that exist in the state. Of those exotic species, however, about 165 are problematic. They're actually invading natural areas in one way or another, but only half of that 165, according to the Florida Exotic Pest Plant Council, are creating population level effects, altering ecosystem function, altering ecosystem structure, architecture, displacing and pushing out entirely native species. So even though there are lots of exotic species and some of those are problematic, it's a small proportion, and still, fortunately for me, a large enough proportion that I'll have a job until long after I want to retire and trying to deal with these exotic species. Now, one of the first controversies that comes into biological control, and if you read the abstract, I want to talk a little bit about controversies here, and that's, I guess, how I get tied into a symposium session on evil. Is that we're going to talk about these controversies in biological control. But while most of us would consider the displacement of native species, the monoculture takeover of what are diverse plant communities otherwise, as being a bad thing, there are ecologists, and I only recently actually ran across these guys, there's a whole group of ecologists who would argue that moral judgments are beyond the scope, beyond the ken of biologists and ecologists, and that we should not in science be dealing with moral decision-making at all. we should say we're studying this because it's new, it's invaded, let's study its invasion, whatever. But we should stop at the point of saying this day's invasion is bad. The replacement of this old species that was there before with this new species is bad. We shouldn't say that. Of course, the lay public kind of buys into that in some regards, because to many in the lay public, as long as it's green, it's good. I want to go walking out in the woods, and I don't care what's in the woods as long as there's a woods for me to walk into. They don't know any better, and we don't educate them to know any better. However, from a Christian environmentalist perspective, we know that God said what he created is good. What he put together, these interactions between species that we call plant and animal communities, was good. And if we're doing something that is disrupting what God called as good, then it's okay for us to call it bad, and even more, to act as though it's bad and start behaving in a way to try and stop it and or mitigate or create against it. And so with that as my standing point, and I'll hopefully I won't run over by doing this, but briefly, I was trying to figure out during lunchtime prayer at work one day, why in the world am I doing biocontrol, Lord? Because that's not what I'm a marine biologist who then had to get fresh water, and I wind up down in South Florida working in Lake Okeechobee and only incidentally with a group that was doing biological control, and I had never heard of it till I was there and they were telling me that's what we were doing. Oh, that's what I'm doing? Okay, great. And I'm asking the Lord in prayer one day, why am I doing biocontrol? Because that's not what I wanted to be. And in one of those rare occasions when the Lord spoke to me loudly enough that I could actually hear him, or I was listening particularly well in that case, he just went, you're putting back together what I put together in the first place. Okay then, I will shut up and go do my job now. Thank you, Lord. And I've been in biocontrol ever since and haven't tried to get out, because I get the privilege of trying to rebuild the systems that God built in the first place, these interactions that are not damaging in the first place. So what does biocontrol mean? You can see here the definition. I'm not one who tries to read to people, so I'm going to let you read on your own. But essentially, it's reassociating species that were once together, a host that has been moved with its controlling organisms from its original location. That's what we do. The goal, as you'll note here, is to stress the host sufficiently so that it becomes rehabilitated. That's really critical, because so many people think that biological control, like chemical or mechanic control, is all about trying to eliminate the bad behavior, the bad plant in the system. And by the time they get to us and we can do biological control on them, they're not going to be going anywhere. They will always be a part of the plant communities and ecosystems that they have become introduced to. However, we can make them behave better so that they're not creating the problems that they were creating initially. So how do you do biological control? Well, the process has been described as being a pipeline, for our purposes, that's a pretty good description. Essentially, we identify a weed, or somebody identifies for us a weed that's a problem they want controlled. And then we do some genetic work to determine where exactly it came from. Based on that genetic work, we go overseas and we try to find organisms that are creating stress against those plants in their native range. Sometimes those are relatively rare species, because they themselves are being controlled by their own natural enemies. Other times they're quite abundant and it becomes really clear that it's something that we should be able to go after. We don't want to create a problem with our solution. So it's really critical overseas, and then when we bring them back into the United States into our quarantine facility, that we test them and make certain that they will not attack anything else. They're not going to complete development on or damage anything else. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Then we monitor when we get permission regulatorily to release them. We monitor them after we get them established. We redistribute them sometimes. One of the beauties of biocontrol is that these organisms grow themselves, so you don't have to keep buying new chemicals. They're just doing their own thing. And they spread themselves, but sometimes they spread themselves slowly, and so we want to accelerate that process. And so we get involved in programs that will help us to redistribute the insects. And finally, we transfer the technology so that on the plant that I'm currently working on, air potato, we actually have a program where residents can contact us or several of our colleagues and say, we need some bugs on this bad plant. And we will ship them a little box with 20 or 25 insects in it, and they'll release them in their backyard to help fight this plant. And so then they contact and give us information back about what's going on, and it's a really good way to engage the common lay public in what's happening. and get their buy-in. Now, this process is actually not so much like a pipeline, it is an iterative approach. And again, we don't have to go through all this. The main purpose of this slide is simply to say, when we work our way through the system at any stage where we fail, if an insect starts to show that it's ovipositing on a multitude of plants and that the larvae can complete development after they hatch on those plants, we drop the insect. If the insect looks like it just is really difficult to keep it going on the plant in the first place, and so maybe it's only a secondary host, we drop that insect. We start over with another one. At different stages along the process, anywhere where it looks like we're going to create a problem, we stop, eliminate that insect, and come back into the iterative process and start it over again. Of course, safety is the most critical thing that people are worried about. They're worried that we're going to create another problem, and we're worried about that too. So the process is set up in such a way that we use what we call the phylogenetic centrifugal method, where we start testing organisms that are most closely related to the target species and work our way out from there, including economic species, species that occur ecologically in similar types of habitat, and if we have a twofer, in my case, for instance, with the air potato, in the Caribbean, there are species that are used relatively close relatives that are used as food crops, and so we do economic and ecological studies both in that case. And then we also look at if the proposed insect that we're using has relatives that damage other plants, then we look at relatives of those other plants to see if our insect will attack those as well. We try to cover all of our bases. What that's meant in the case of Liliaceris aegina, the insect that I'm working on at the moment on air potato, is that I tested 82 plant species within 46 families and 25 orders, quite extensive, and then passed it on to the regulatory agencies, and they're working through the process now. I think it's going to be acceptable because in my particular case, not only was it a specialist on the plant, it's a specialist on the reproductive organs of the plant only, and so the females will only ovipositing on one small part of the plant, and that's it. How does safety work out historically? Safety works out historically in the United States. There have been 153 agents released. And essentially, what this slide tells you is there have been some species, some insects that are attacking other plants. Oh, that's bad, isn't it? Except, and if you, by the way, if you're an ecologist here and you read the classic textbooks, then you'll read Svetlana's work, which tries to make it look like that we're attacking lots of native species all over the place with our biocontrol insects and we shouldn't be doing biocontrol. She's made a great career out of that, ignoring the data that I'm talking about right now. And those data are this. Physiological host range studies, the kinds that I do, predicted all of those attacks but one. In the one case when it wasn't predicted, it's because it was before we were doing physiological host range studies. An insect was brought in against Lantana on Hawaii in 1902 and just thrown out willy-nilly. Nobody cared. And that one creates a lot of problems. The other cases that are cited, and a most famous example is Rhinocytis conicus, which is a European weevil that attacks thistles. And the host range, so let's make sure we get it right. So they attack European thistles. When it was brought over and released here, 22 of 90 native species of thistles turned out to be attacked by Rhinocinus. This is where Svada made her living. Oh, it's so bad. Look at all the damage going on. Wait, time. Let's go back to the original reports. In the original reports, 4 genera and multiple species within each of the genuses, within a subfamily, all were known to be attacked by this insect. This was not a specialist. This was an oligophagous insect that attacks a very narrow group of plants, but anything within that narrow group of plants. So it's not a surprise that our U.S. species were attacked because we already knew it attacked more things than it should. So what is our safety record? Our safety record is that there are 0 insects that have been released in the last 125 years in weed biocontrol that attack anything we did not know they would attack. Why was Rhinocyclus conicus released, you would ask me? Because the political pressure to control thistles in rangelands where cattle could not graze was more important at a time when ecology was just starting to blossom, be recognized as being important. And so the powers that make these decisions said, let it go. All right, efficacy is another one of those things that's a problem, and because I'm going to be running out on time soon, I'm just going to kind of jump through this really quick. But essentially, not everything we release establishes, and not everything that we establish really causes the kinds of effects that we want. Many insects that we release don't seem to do much of anything. They just kind of hang out and live there, but they're not really creating the stresses that we would like to have created. In some cases, that's because we can't really test. In many developing countries, they get insects from us, they release them against a problem plant that we have too, and then that they don't have the money to follow up. So they don't even know if it establishes or not. And so the literature is replete with examples where an insect has been released and then we don't know if it established in their country, and we don't know if it's causing any kind of damage. We don't know if it's causing bad damage either. One of the things about efficacy that's been controversial in biocontrol more recently is people want us to predict efficacy before we release. Why spend money on developing an insect when you don't know whether it's going to be efficacious or not? Well, the problem is, to predict efficacy, you have to be able to recreate these habitats, like the ones I'm showing you here, that the insects and plants came from, and or the habitats that they're going to be released in. Imagine trying to do that in a 20 by 30 foot glass house that's insect escape proof, where you're controlling the temperature, the heat, the light, and humidity. It's not real. And anything you do is not going to come out real in that case. So we overtest for safety by making sure that the most extreme possibility of feeding is available to the insects. But you can't flip that on the other side and say, just what happens if a lightning storm scares this insect out of the way? Efficacy is difficult to predict, not only because creating the habitat is difficult, but because the interactions between insects and plants and between plants and plants is really complex. And we just can't model all of those in a reasonable way inside of a quarantine. And the final controversy within biological control is, how do you judge success? Like this Muscovy duck, success is in the eye of the beholder. I think this is one of the ugliest ducks God ever created, and I don't like them being in Florida, and they're an invasive in Florida. However, some people really love this duck. So it just depends on who's looking at it, whether there's a success or how you measure it. So in the case of the Melaleuca plant that I was talking about before, the tree, excuse me, we were part of a group of land managers and scientists who wanted to control this plant and came together in the late 1980s and said, let's put together a plan. One of the first times it's been done in the United States or the world. We put together a plan before we actually started doing anything. And we put together an integrated pest management plan to approach this. And biocontrol was given a specific set of functions in terms of preventing regeneration of the plant and slowing its growth overall. And these are the outcomes. Now, by any quantitative measure that you want to use, these numbers that I got that I put before you show that we were successful in a great measure at reducing flowering, seeding, regrowth, seedling mortality, sapling growth is greatly limited. But there are people that will walk out in the landscape and say, "But Melaleuca is still here, and I still can't get it back into this stand. So it's a failure." Well, no. We did what we were told that we should do. And we are reducing the plants overall. You can see that they're gone. However, it's not everywhere that somebody would want. So if we can get out of the forest and get out from amongst the weeds, we can answer any additional questions you might have. I know, a bad joke, but my students all know that I tell bad jokes, and y'all had to get at least one just so you suffer as much as they do. Thank you for listening. You've been very attentive, and I think I still have some time for questions, plus all you're going to miss is food anyway.
Is there a question?
Yes, sir.
You're much more informed in this than I am, but, you know...
Isn't that why we do all these things in the first place? We talk to somebody else that we know more of?
Are you encouraged broadly?
Okay.
You know, we spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money with one invasive, and sometimes it feels like five others get...
I am not encouraged. I made the joke at the beginning saying that I think that that my job is secure for the rest of my career and even my children's careers if they wanted to have them. But the truth of the matter is, going back to the beginning, why we need biocontrol in the first place, because we move plants around so much, because we move other organisms around so much, it's only becoming worse. I do the plant side, but I work with colleagues in the Everglades that The python started becoming a problem 10 years ago, and now it's moved 50 to 60 miles north of where we first started seeing it as a problem. Reproductive populations are as far north as the north part of Lake Okeechobee. It's moving toward Georgia at a rapid rate. It will get there. And there's not a thing we can do about it. It's too late. The only thing that stops this kind of problem in the first place is to restrict access before insects or plants or whatever get in. And we really financially can't afford that. If you look at the amount of cargo ships that move back and forth and things that are just coming being moved back and forth, to examine all of them, even if we could have the tools where we could see fungal spores inside of that container, we don't have the manpower, we don't have the money, we don't have the willpower to do that. So preventing the problem, which is the best way to do it, is not available to us. So the best we can hope for is to pick out the worst, most problematic weeds that are out there and try to mitigate their impact on the natural systems. And that's what the lab that I work at does. We're all well aware that we will never solve the problem and that there are more problems coming behind. But what we want to do is mitigate the worst ones that are out there right now. And the Florida Exotic Pest Plant Council that I mentioned, that's essentially what they focus on. They have a list called Category 1 Plants. That's where that 80 species that I talked about came from. And they prioritize within that as well. And so our Melaleuca management plan was the first, but they now have management plans on what they consider the next 10 most damaging in Florida plant species. And we have propagated Flepsies around the country. So there are exotic pest plant councils throughout the United States now, and they all do the same thing within their region or their state. What are the worst problems we're facing right now, and can we at least get money to address those and try to mitigate those? That's the best we're going to be able to hope for, in my opinion. Is that a fair answer? Okay. Yeah, Paul.
Yeah, I agree with you. The problem is, look at all the steps we have to take properly so to bring in an insect, examine it, and literally years and years of research, and then this torturous review process. Mm-hmm. And yet commerce now today, with things moving all over the world all the time, anybody can put something in their pocket. I mean, at the ag stations when you fly in, that they'll ask you, are you carrying anything? But like you say, cargo ships, everything, really. It's kind of hopeless when you look at it.
Yeah, it is that.
Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
It was delightful. Appreciate it. I came up the zoological side, so that's where I was going. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. It's been a delightful afternoon. Thanks to the speakers. And